I would like to dedicate this year to a very, very special human being whose Levaya was yesterday. His name was Moshe Avital. His proper name was Moshe Nechemia Ben Yoshua. He was Nifter, I believe he was 92. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was in Auschwitz. He was in Buchenwald, three other camps. He started the Holocaust. He was 14 years old. He had almost nobody left by the time the Holocaust was over. He was one of 11 siblings. Most of his siblings were murdered. His parents were murdered. He came from a village called Bilka. Pretty much the entire village was murdered. And he made it his life's mission. If anybody here went to SAR, maybe you met him. Lived in New Rochelle. He was the father-in-law of my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law's father. His levaya was yesterday. They're still sitting shiva. So I wanted to dedicate this in his memory. He also, after the Holocaust, came to Israel and fought in the... he joined the, I believe, the Haganah. And he fought in Melchemet HaShechrur. He actually was one of the men who held the line against the Egyptians in Kibbutz Ramat Rachel, which is a 30-40 minute walk from here. He also spent some time in a mutzav on top of Har Tzion. When I tell you the story of Har Tzion, he's part of that story. So we're going to dedicate this in his memory. I want to tell you an unbelievable story. Okay? It's... Pardon? Oh, yeah, sure. It's the summer of 1943. Okay? And it was a blistering hot day towards the end of July. And they were going out on a work detail like they did every day. There were 40 of them. 20 Polish Jews, 20 Dutch Jews. They marched into the forest from Sobibor, one of the death camps. And there were two men who had worked hard to get on this detail, unbeknownst to the Ukrainian guards, the Nazis. And they were waiting for an opportunity. Every day, in the middle of the day, they all took a lunch break. The guards wanted to chill. The workers were given like 20 minutes to just sit. And two workers were sent with two, kind of like out of the movies, sticks with like buckets on them, down to the river, about a mile down from where they were working in the forest, to come back with buckets of water for the guards and the men. Now, it was a detail that nobody wanted, which meant that if you wanted to volunteer, it was an easy detail to get, right? These two men had been doing it for 2 weeks, right? And for some reason, the guards never figured out that this was their interest. The reason nobody wanted this detail is because obviously if you got 20 minutes to stop working, the torture of the work in the forest when you were sawing trees, the Nazis would make a point of putting like a tall guy with a short guy, so the short guy had to go up on his toes when he was pulling the saw, and the tall guy would have to bench over and get like horrible back pain nonstop. So you finally got 20 minutes. The last thing you want to do is have to schlep two buckets of water on your Holocaust rations. Anyway, the day finally came, and their opportunity presented itself. For some reason on this particular day, instead of two guards going with them, only one guard went down to the river. They seized the opportunity, waited for the right moment. They pulled out two knives that they'd hidden in their boots. They quickly overcame the guard, killed him, took his rifle, and went running off into the forest. They had made their escape. The names of these two prisoners were Yosef Knopf and Shlomo Pudzlibnik. Right? Now, eventually, the Nazis realized that something was wrong because the guy wasn't coming back. So they sent a few guards down. 20 minutes after that, the few guards came running back. They found the guard dead. The two had escaped. And all mayhem broke loose. Now, the 20 Dutch Jews, they knew they had no chance to escape because they didn't speak the language. So even if they could get away from the Nazis, they'd be caught in a minute and they'd be murdered. So they stayed, right? But the Poles split up. They fought against their guards. They used the knives and the pickaxes that they had for their work detail. And 11 of them actually managed to escape, right? Some of them were killed on the spot. The 11 managed to escape. And they were eventually all caught, but five. Five people actually managed to escape in addition to those two prisoners. But the others who were brought back, 11 of them, sorry, right? They were eventually captured. The 20 Dutch Jews were executed on the spot. The 11 remaining Poles were forced to crawl back to the camp. It was a few miles, on their elbows and knees. And when they finally reached the camp, in a scene that has been made famous in the movie Escape to Sobibor, which, by the way, if you never saw that movie, I highly recommend it. It's a powerful movie to watch on Tisha B'Av. I'm sure we can get it for you if you guys want to see it. It's really an amazing movie, based on a true story. And they bring them back to the camp, and they line them up, and they call a roll call. And of course, there's nothing worse for the Nazis than an escape. They're determined to make sure that everybody understands that there will be no escape. So they tell these 11 Jews, before we murder you, each of you is going to pick one of your comrades from the roll call to join him in this line. Now, of course, they know they're going to die. Nobody picks anybody. So the SS commandant walks over to one of the lines, finds a boy, shoots him in the head. Then he looks at the 11 prisoners. He says, I'm going to count to three and shoot another one. And I will keep doing that all day until every single prisoner here is dead if you don't pick 11 prisoners. They have no choice. So eventually they pick 11 prisoners and they line them up. And in this famous scene, which is true, and survivors shared this story, the foreman of this group yells out at the last instant before they open up on them, right? Avenge us. Remember us. Avenge us. Now, because of this event, by the way, the inmates in Sobibor realized that if they have to plan, if they're going to plan an escape, because they knew eventually they were all going to be murdered, that was the nature of Sobibor, they can't leave anybody behind. Because if some of them escape, they see what the Nazis will do to whoever's left behind. How can you escape and have that on your conscience? So that's what forced them to decide that if they were going to plan an escape, every prisoner in the camp was going to have an opportunity to escape. This is a very difficult thing to do because some of the units in the camp, the Sonderkommando for the ones who cleaned out the bodies in the gas chamber, had no contact with the other parts of the camp. So this is a very complicated operation. And that's why on October 14th, which is 2 weeks from now, on October 14th, in the summer of 1943, over 600 prisoners overcame their guards, broke the fence, and escaped into the forest. 300 of them actually made it into the forest. 300 were killed trying to escape. And we know of 51 who actually did survive. There's some from that day, their whereabouts were never accounted for, and nobody knows what happened to them. Murdered by Poles, disappeared, changed identity, nobody knows. Right? So that story happened because of this escape. Now these two prisoners, Josef Knopf and Shlomo Pudzlebnik, they actually succeeded in surviving. They hid with various Poles throughout the forest for over a year. They had planned this escape. They had, you know, they worked where they worked in the Sonderkommando in Sobibor. They were able to get all sorts of materials from Jews that died. And this is the stuff that they used to bribe Poles sort of and survive over a year. They were finally liberated by the Russians. Their area was liberated. And 2 weeks after the liberation, Josef Knopf made a fatal mistake. He went back to his village. He had actually hidden some treasure, whatever wealth he had, in the garden of a good friend of his, a Pole. He found this Pole, and he figured, you know, he's done. After everything he survived, the Nazis liberated, the war is over. He was shot by the Pole in the back of the head a day later. How they found this story out is a story in and of itself, because this Pole eventually bragged it in a drinking spree. Shlomo Pudzlebnik, however, survived. He survived the war, and he ended up getting to America. And his family never knew this whole story. He married and had one child, a boy named Charlie. And at Charlie's bar mitzvah, he stood up at the bar mitzvah, right, and finally told this story. And he pulled out of his pocket I'm going to get the details right here, an 18-carat pink gold chronograph watch, which was the watch he had taken off the dead Ukrainian guard that they had killed in making their escape. He had kept it all these years, and he wanted to give it to his son, sorry, to his grandson, I have to check which it was, I think it was his son, at his bar mitzvah. And I read this story in the papers, and it blew me away, this story. I'd never heard this story before. And I got I put this in a bite for a writer, and it eventually got the article ended up in the Jewish Star or someplace. And I get an email about a week or two later from this boy named Charlie, who's now an adult, who filled out the story for me. He said he was so moved to see the story in the paper, and he read it, and he wanted to write to me and whatever and thank me telling the story. And he told me that he had never known that whole story until the day of his bar mitzvah. And he said only years later, right, when they were celebrating his 40th birthday and he started telling the story of this watch, did he suddenly realize and start to think about where that Ukrainian soldier had gotten that watch from, working in a death camp, right? Now, I tell you this story because there's an interesting thought when it comes to Sukkot. What is it exactly that we're doing, right? Tomorrow night, we're going to get into the sukkah, right? Every year, 4 days after Yom Kippur, don't worry, have a little faith, it'll be fine, right? Every year, 4 days after Yom Kippur, we build this hut. We leave our homes, and we're supposed to live in the hut, right? What is that all about? So I want to share with you a very interesting idea, okay? It's an interesting question. If you look in Bereishit, right? It's an unlikely place to find a Dvar Torah and Sukkos. But let me share with you an interesting detail, okay? You remember the story of Yaakov and Esav, right? 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 Yaakov at the beginning of Parashat Vayishlach. Yaakov is finally coming back to Israel after 22 years in the house of Lavan. Okay? And messengers come to him and say, Vinei Esav achicha bali kratecha, Esav is coming towards you. Verbamot ishimo. There's an army of 400 men with him. 400 men, 4,000 years ago, was an enormous army. Do the math. The population today relative to the world then has increased at least 1,000 times, right? So think about that. That's 400,000 men. It's an enormous army. So, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od Vayetzalo. Yaakov is terrified. It's a very difficult pasuk, but we're not going to go there right now. So he does whatever he does. He has a strategy. He splits up his camp. He sends messages with gifts. Eventually he meets Esav. They fall on each other's shoulders. Is it a real rapprochement? Is it hiding other intentions? Is Esav really a Russia? Is he a purely wicked person, or is he just a person with a Yetzer? That's a topic for when we get to Parshat Vayishlach. But Esav finally leaves, right? And what does it say? Vayashav bayomahu Esav ledarko Seira. Esav goes back on his way to Seir. You can imagine what the commentaries, especially the Hasidic commentaries, do with that path. When a Russia goes back to his path. This is not a pasuk denoting that he finishes Yevamos and he wants to start Kiddushin, right? He's back to where he was. Esav misses an enormous moment because Esav encounters Yaakov and they fix it. Yaakov somehow makes a rapprochement. So Esav's at a crossroads in his life. Is he going to stay Esav or is he going to join Yaakov? He actually asks Yaakov to join him. And Yaakov says, I don't need to. Esav says, Yeshli Rav, I have so much, I don't need it all. Come join me. Yaakov says, Yeshli Kol, I have everything I need. And so they part ways, right? There are three possibilities in that moment. Yaakov can join Esav, and the future of the Jewish people is doomed. Esav can join Yaakov, and the world will be where it's supposed to be. The peace will come. Redemption will come. Can you imagine if Yaakov and Esav had both joined forces, learned Torah? Unbelievable, right? How many forefathers were there? No? Three. How many foremothers were there? Four. Rashi quotes the Medrash. There were supposed to be four fathers. Avram married Sarah. He was supposed to. Yitzchak married Rivka. He was supposed to. Yaakov married Rachel. But before Yaakov came Esav, Esav was the Bechor. He was supposed to marry Leah. The Medrash says, and Rashi quotes this Medrash, which means it's an important Medrash, that the reason that Veinei Leah Rakot, that Leah's eyes were somehow softened or there was something wrong with them, one day the Medrash says, because the salt of her tears destroyed her eyes. Right? Why was she crying so much? Because she knew she was destined to marry Esav. So when Yaakov takes the Bechorah and the Bracha from Esav, Leah says, now you've acquired me as well. And so Yaakov becomes Yaakov and Esav. Now that paradigm could have been different. Yaakov and Esav could have joined forces.
Esav would have married Leah, Yaakov would have married Rachel. Can you imagine how different the world would have been? But Esav returns to his derech. So now you're Yaakov. You just survived Esav. Esav goes on his path and you're continuing in yours. What do you do? What do you do? You're Yaakov. You survived Lavan. You survived Esav. You've come back. You just crossed the border into Eretz Israel. Where do you go? Come on, Nu, where do you go? What do you think? Where do you go? Give me a few possibilities. You're Yaakov. You're the grandson of Avraham Avinu. You just got back to Eretz Israel. Where do you go? Pardon? Chevron. That would be a good one. Go to visit the graves of your father, of your grandfather, right? Who goes to Chevron when he gets to Eretz Israel? Anybody know? Kalev ben Yefuneh. He's one of the 12 spies. Yeshua doesn't have to go with him because Yeshua's been blessed by Moshe. But Kalev knows he's in for a hard ride. He's clear he's in bad company. You know, he's in university and the guys around him are just not. They don't want a chavrusa. They want a beer chavrusa, you know. So he goes to Hebron. Yaakov doesn't go to Hebron. Where else could he go? He could go to Beersheba. Now, Beersheba would be getting back to his roots. It's not quite the same Kedusha as Hebron, but okay, I could hear that. Go find out what's left of his home. If you buy that they left from Beersheba, what else? Come on. Really?
Here.
Where? Here. He could go here.
There's nothing here, though.
There's one daya that says that Beit El was really Yerushalayim. According to Jewish tradition, remember, midrashically, here is everything. This is the makom. This is the makom, vayaret ha-makom merachok. Right? Ba-makom asher yivchar Hashem lasim etzmo sham. The word makom in Tanakh refers to this place. It is the makom, the ultimate place. It's the source of creation. Right? Kabbalistically, the Evan Shasia, the Evan Yetzirah, the rock of formation from where the Kabbalists believe the whole world was created. It's right here. This is where Yaakov's father was offered up almost, sort of, wasn't, right? So you got to figure Yaakov knows this place. In fact, there's even one day that says Beit El. It's not Pshat, but there's one day in the Medrash that says that this is actually Beit El, where Yaakov sleeps, where he, you know, builds his famous altar. So I would think you come here. Can somebody name another possibility? Come on. Let's see who really knows. Where do the Jewish people go when they get back to Israel? They come out of Egypt. They cross the border. First place they go? Where? Nope. That's actually a mistake. Yericho is not the first place they go. Where's the first place they go? I'll give you a hint. It's the first place Avraham goes, according to Rashi. Vayelech Avraham aloch v'nasoah ha-negba. No, where does Avram go? Where does Avram go to Sukkot? It's not even mentioned by Avram. Har Grizim and Har Eval. Har Grizim and Har Eval. You never heard that medrash?
No.
Wow. Look, it's right in the beginning of Lech Lecha. Hashem shows him Har Grizim and Har Eval. Hashem tells Moshe, and Moshe tells Yeshua, when you cross over the Jordan River, go to Har Grizim and Har Eval, and you will build an altar there. On Har Eval. Okay? And amazingly, a professor named Adam Zertal, after 8 different archaeological attempts, discovers this altar. Unbelievable. Measures it. It fits exactly the measurements as described in the Mishnah of Midot. He finds a scarab, which is like a form of an idol, Egyptian idol, that dates back to over 3,000 years ago, exactly the period of time that many people think Bnei Israel came here. He claims... It's okay. You can leave it. He claims... He claims that it's the first instance where archaeology has verified a biblical event. Okay? By the way, it's clear that that altar is not Canaanite, because the Canaanite altars all faced it west, east to west, because they prayed to the sun, right? And therefore, Jewish altars did not face that direction. It also, they know it wasn't the Canaanite altar, because there are no unclean, impure animal bones. There's no pigs there. There's no... It's all, you know, sort of the cattle that the Jews offered up. So they're convinced that this is a biblical event. Now, why the first place Am Yisrael goes? They cross over the river. They go straight to Har Shechem, right? Har Grizim and Har Eval. You know, where Yosef is buried. That's why Yosef is buried there, because that's the first place they go. Although I guess you could say that they go to there first so they can bury Yosef. And that has a whole message in and of itself. What are those mountains? Why are they... But that's not where Yaakov goes. He doesn't go to Hebron. He doesn't go to Yerushalayim. He doesn't go to Har Gerizim or Har Eval. You know where he goes? This is interesting. Everybody laughed at Josh. Watch Josh be right. Right? For Yaakov, Nasa, want to take a guess? Sukkota. He goes to Sukkot. Vayiven lo bayit uli mikneu asa Sukkot. And he builds a house. It's a great trivia question. You know, you run into some friends from, I don't know, the Mir, Kush, Kambi Avne. Say, where was the first place the Jews settled in Eretz Yisrael? And they came back. And they'll all say, oh, you know, Shechem. They'll say, you know, because Yaakov brought a chelka in Shechem. Nope. He builds a house in Sukkot. That was the first time Jews came back, right? And built a house. Vayiven lo bayit ulimikneu asa Sukkot. And he made Sukkot for his cattle. Booths, huts, right? That they could stay protected in the elements. Al-Kain. Now, Al-Kain kara shema makom Sukkot. And therefore he calls the place Sukkot. Ask me an obvious question. I mean, this is really obvious question, right? Well, no, it's wherever it is, yeah. Okay, so that's one question. The person said he went to Sukkot, but it couldn't have been called Sukkot yet, because it's called Sukkot because he built the Sukkot. If he hadn't built the Sukkot yet, why is it called Sukkot? But you could answer that and say the Torah knows what's going to be. It's the place that we now know as Sukkot. He went there and built the Sukkot, that's why it's called Sukkot. You could say that. I agree with you, it's a good question. But there's an even better question. Yeah, Simcha Malina. Pardon?
Why is it never sourced in the actual holiday of Sukkot?
Who says it's never sourced? It's about to be sourced.
All right.
Okay. New? I mean, I assume you figured out by now the reason we're talking about this is because Sukkot is coming up. Yeah?
Why did Yaakov build it?
Well, we're going to talk about that too. That's a good question. That's a question about any place anybody goes, but okay. Well, it says why they built Sukkot. They built Sukkot. Why did they build Sukkot here? For his cattle. Wow, nobody catches this question, huh? You go to a place, you build your house. It's the first place you build a house. You're married now, you have children, you build your own house. And you build huts for your animals. And you name the place Huts for the Animals? That's the name of the place? We came to Yerushalayim, we built a yeshiva and a raita, and we built an outhouse in the back. And we called the place Outhouse. That's ridiculous. Why is this place called Sukkot? Why is this place called Sukkot? Why is the first place that a Jew names after returning to Eretz Yisrael, right? Avram names places. Why does Avram name Beersheba, Beersheba? Because he swore an oath there. He made a treaty. That was a powerful statement. Yitzchak renames the place Beersheba. He upheld the treaty of his father. Yerushalayim is called Yerushalayim because Yeru, because you see Hashem completely. It's about Yir Shamayim, about the awe of heaven, right? Hebron is a chibur to the land of Israel, a connection, because that's where we buried our forefathers. Sukkot for the animal huts? Really? Do you agree with me? That's a little strange. So I want to give you a deep idea. I want to give you a deep idea. It's not an accident that the festival of Sukkot comes right after Yom Kippur. Where do I find the sukkah in Yom Kippur? Let's see if anybody knows this. Where is the sukkah alluded to on the day of Yom Kippur? Everybody misses this. I can't take credit for this idea. I first heard this in a shiur from Rav Meidan. Shibad al-chayim arukim, zecher, shiyichel olam yamin tov amamin, my Rebbe in Gush, Rosh Shiv in Gush now. Yeah? Excellent! That's two for two. You know what that means? Shana Bet. Or straight to Smicha. Yeah. Now you know that whoever sang that niggun is staying also. I'm just saying. Okay. Oh. And everyone went, oh, probably isn't. Anyway, so Yonah, otherwise known as Yonah, at the end of the story of the book of Yonah, okay? He's given this mission. He doesn't want to fulfill this mission. By the way, the whole book of Yonah is all about non-Jews. It's all about non-Jews. There's something about Yom Kippur that's bigger than just the Jewish people. But okay. So Yonah, right, he doesn't want to save the Ninevites, the Assyrians, because he knows what they're coming to do. And he was right. A generation later, they exile the 10 tribes, and they prove the source of our destruction. Hashem is basically giving a message. You don't get to judge people based on where you think they're going. See people as they are. You know what I mean? That's a whole idea. So he goes, and he says, you got to do tshuva. The story of Nineveh is crazy. Right? Jonah is walking around the city of Nineveh. He's like, oh, the Rabbayim Yom Vayunet Pachet. 40 days, and the whole city is going to be destroyed. What happens? Remember? The king says, oh my God, we got to do tshuva. This is bad. So he gets the whole city, everybody does tshuva. Did you ever think about that? Guy just spent 3 days in the belly of a whale or a big fish. Can you imagine what a guy who was just spewed up by a fish after 3 days, what he must smell like? What he must look like? I remember once, I was in the New York City subway. Right? There are three places that you get the best stories. The first, obviously, is the Holocaust. The second is the Israeli army. And the third is the New York City subway, right? So I'm on the subway, and I had a meeting, and the train gets to 59th Street, Columbus Circle, if you know New York City. I come up on the Columbus Circle. There's a guy standing at the top of the steps. He's wearing a business suit, right? Nice haircut, right? And I come up, and he suddenly says, oh my God, and he grabs my arm. I'm like, what? He goes, look! He's a guy in a suit. I feel, oh my God, what's going on? You know, that fire, right? Now, we're in New York. New Yorkers don't grab your arm unless they want your money, right? It's like, but okay. So I'm looking, I don't see anything. It takes me a minute to realize the guy has no shoes on. He's whacked out of his brain. I don't know what it is he's seeing, right? So you see a guy like Jonah running around the city. The whole city is going to be overturned. And you listen to him, the king listens to him. It was a fanatical tshuva. It was a crazy tshuva. Okay, so they all do tshuva somehow. And what does Yonah do? He wants to see what's going to be. Is the tshuva real? Ezo hi tshuva gemura. Is this going to work? So he sits outside the city, and Hashem, right, sends a tree, a kikayon. Okay? Right? And the kikayon grows up over Yonah, right? Now, it's interesting. There are four things in the book of Yonah that are prepared, according to the Medrash, from the dawn of creation, by Hashem. And there is a word that is used, which is a very specific word. It's very rare to use this word. And that is the word vayaman. Okay? Hashem planned. Hashem prepared. Okay? Hashem prepared the fish. And after the story of Nineveh, Hashem prepared this deadly Santa Ana wind, this Ruach Sa'ara, which threatens to overwhelm Yonah. It's devastating if you've ever been in a chamsin. But then Hashem sends this kikayon, right? This bush, this little tree. By the way, you can go today into the Judean desert. You can see what a kikayon looks like. It's very interesting. It's a tree which is very low, and its leaves spread out, right? And the space between the leaves is very small, provides shade. But the way it's built, hot air rises. So as hot air rises and hits the leaves, it filters through the leaves and it creates an updraft. And that's why when you sit in the desert under a kikayon, there's always a breeze. It's the Bedouin teach you that, right? And you do survival training. But then Hashem sends a worm. And the worm destroys, right? Vayaman destroys the tree. And so finally, Yonah's lost it totally, and he starts to call out to God, like, what's going on? And finally, Hashem says, right, he asks the question at the end of the book of Yonah. He says, you, Chasta, you're all worried about a bush, which I created in a day and destroyed in a day. I shouldn't worry about the people of Nineveh? Right? 100,000 people, 10 rivavot, who have been created since the dawn of creation, that are human beings. I shouldn't worry about them? Good question, and that's how the book ends. You know what the problem with that question is? Who's right? Hashem or Yonah? Yonah. Because the analogy of Akash Baruch Hu does not work. Hashem compares the people of Nineveh to the Kikayon, but Hashem doesn't need the people of Nineveh. Yonah needs the bush. So Yonah should say, you're wrong. I need the bush. That's why I'm upset. But you don't need the people of Nineveh. They're going to do wickedness. Unless you say that everybody in the story of Nineveh, the whole point of the story of Yonah, is that everything is part of Hashem's plan. Everything. Even a little bush. Yonah is sitting under the sukkah. The definition of a sukkah is that it's temporary. It's a hut you build for animals. It's not a place people live. Right? All the things in this world, what is the message of the sukkah? The message of the sukkah, you know, it's interesting, by the way, Chag HaSukkot is Chag HaSif. It's the festival of the harvest. It's the time when the whole thing, the whole journey makes sense. I bring in the harvest. And when you bring in the harvest, you know what you feel when you bring in the harvest? Look at me. Kochi v'otzem yadi asat ha'davar hazeh. I plowed, I threshed, I winnowed. Look at this wealth. Look at me. Look how much I have. So exactly in that moment, we step outside our homes and we walk into the sukkah. As if to say, don't make the mistake that this stuff is what matters. Don't think that what you have is who you are. What you have is not who you are. It's not even what you have. Because you don't really have what you have. The only thing you really have is the way you look at the world. Right? So to be able to realize that the house is really temporary and the temporary is really a blessing, that's a completely different perspective. So I go outside after Yom Kippur and I sit inside the sukkah and I remember what life is really about. It's not about what I accrue. It's not about the money I make. It's not about the degree I make. It's not about whether I got into medical school or whether I get a new car or all the things that you can talk about and you know intellectually are just not what life is about, but you get sucked up into that life. Did anybody here in 4 years of high school ever buy anything because you wanted to wear the brand name? You know, you bought a pair of sneakers because you liked the fact that they have the Nike swirl. Somebody here must have done that at some point. You realize it's such an illusion. The fact that there's a swirl on a sneaker doesn't make it any better than another sneaker. It may be better than another sneaker for other reasons, but not because of the Nike swirl. We live in this world of branding and illusion. It's not real. So I sit in the sukkah, and in the sukkah, I have to be able to see the stars because I have to remember what life is really about. It's not what I build. It's what Hashem gives me to build. It's the motivation that I have to build. Yaakov is coming out of the world of... You with me here, guys? Yaakov is coming out of the world of Lavan. In the world of Lavan, what matters is how much cattle you have. And after 22 years in the house of Lavan, Yaakov is dreaming about sheep. Yaakov goes down to the house of Lavan, running away from Esav, and he gets to Beit El, which might be here, and he dreams a dream. Do you remember what the dream is about? Right? Ladders to heaven, angels going up and going down and going up. Olim vol, yodim volim, right? Remember? Right? 22 years is in the house of Lavan. He works for 7 years for Rachel. Then he works for 7 years for Leah. Then he's done. Why is he still there? Why doesn't he leave after 14 years? Well, because now he's got to make something of himself, right? You got to pay off your college loans. So he works another 7 years. And then he works another year. And he has a dream. And in the dream, he's dreaming about speckled sheep. Because all the sheep that are speckled, that's his deal with Lavan. You don't usually have speckled sheep. But all the sheep that are speckled, he gets to keep. And he figures out a way, using certain methodologies that we don't really fully understand, to make speckled sheep give birth to more speckled sheep. Some sort of genetic coding, I don't know. And he becomes very wealthy. And an angel comes to him. Do you remember this story? And an angel says, it's time to go home. Lech shuv arza kanan, you need to go home. Do you know what that story is really about? I'll tell you something interesting. Whenever you see, I mentioned this last week, whenever you see one of the characters in Tanakh is communicating with an angel, whatever an angel is, it's not as direct as a communication with Hashem. It's a sure sign that that person somehow has become distant from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. At the beginning of the story of the binding of Yitzchak, Akedat Yitzchak, Avram is speaking directly to Hashem. At the end of the story, he's talking to a malach. Why? Because if you could lift a knife over your son because you think that's what Hashem wants of you, that has to distance you from Hashem. Right? And there's lots of examples of this. So Yaakov's talking to an angel because something's wrong. Because you used to dream about ladders and shamayim, and now you're dreaming about angels, the stock market, that's what you're dreaming about. It's time to go home. So Yaakov comes home, and he almost loses it. He almost discovers in a very real way that what you have is not who you are. You know? Who you are is whether Hashem protects you. That's who you are. What your relationship with Hashem is. How you see the world. If it's about you or about something bigger than you. So when that story ends, Yaakov realizes this is a message he needs to make as a part of his life. He needs to get back to the concept of the sukkah. To recognizing what's really important. Yaakov leaves the house of Yitzchak with nothing but the clothes on his back. Because what he has is not what he has. It's who he is. And he comes back, he's been sucked into the world of Esav. And he narrowly escapes it. And he wants to make sure that that determines who he is. So he names the place Sukkot. Because what's really important about that place is that this world is a temporary hut. It's not real. What's real is what goes way beyond this world. So don't get me wrong. We live in a world of illusion. We have to work according to that illusion. But every once in a while, we get to remember it's an illusion. It's important to go to college. It's important to broaden your horizons. But your college degree does not make you who you are. Your salary doesn't make you who you are. Your profession doesn't make you who you are. What makes you who you are is who you are. You know, what you have is what you give away. What you have is the chesed that you do. What you have is the Torah that you learn. What you have is what you, how much you care for your fellow human being. That's the message of Sukkot. So Mitzvah Shem, tomorrow night we're going to go, we're going to sit in a sukkah. What do you think about when you're sitting in that sukkah? In this year of Corona. How fragile life really is. 1 million people. Do you understand what that is? 1 million people. 1 million people since March. Maybe since February. 6 months. A sixth of the Holocaust in 6 months. And since they say the rate is increasing and not decreasing, can you imagine, lo aleinu, if this continues? There'll be 2 million people dead by this time next year. Sorry, not by this time next year. By March. And maybe there'll be, we can't even imagine that. How many families are there who all over the world, who are sitting with empty chairs at their Shabbos tables? Because of this little minute virus that you can't even see. We live in a sukkah, not a house. And the things we take for granted, we shouldn't take for granted. That's the message of Sukkot. And you know why it's the Chag of Simcha? Because if this world is temporary, and life is really a sukkah, then you got to ask yourself, what am I doing this for? Nobody thinks, you don't sit down in your house on a regular Friday night and say, what's the purpose of my being at my house. That's what you are. It's your house. That's your illusion. But because this is stepping outside of the ordinary, you're leaving your house to go into a temporary booth, people must think you're nuts. You know, in America, like in Israel, Sukkot is the way it's supposed to be experienced. It's getting cool, but it's not winter. Right? Now, on the one hand, I know rabbis in America love to talk about how it's freezing, but we're going to sit in the sukkah. But the truth is, halachically, if you're mitztayer, if it's freezing, you don't have to sit in the sukkah. I remember when I went to Florida. So the first year, we were in Florida for 3 years on Shlichut. Now, Florida is it's a sewer. It's a humid bathtub most of the year. Sukkahs, who here's from Florida? Right? It's not pleasant to sit in the sukkah. Right? Okay? So the first year, I didn't know this. We built a sukkah. And it's like one of those things, I don't know about in your homes, but my house, like we had a sukkah, it was already measured. Like it took me an hour to build our sukkah. All of a sudden, I'm in a new place. I have to find wood. I don't know. They tell me I'm not allowed to attach it to the house because the housing associates had to build a freestanding sukkah. Unbelievable. And I'm sweating out there building the sukkah. I'm so excited. I built my sukkah or whatever. It's the first night. My brother-in-law, actually, they came to us for sukkahs. And we didn't think this through. But we realized it would be hot, so we put a fan in the sukkah. What did we know? And you know what a fan does? Right? Put a fan inside your shower with 200 degree water coming down. You're still sweating. It's just blowing it around. So it was crazy. So the next year, I said, okay, this is ridiculous. I'm not doing this again. It's halacha, right? Everybody knows the halacha. You don't sit in a sukkah when it's pouring rain. Do you know why? Anybody know? Pardon? Not really exactly, because you're not supposed to be a mitztayer. It's true. It's based on that, but really it's because you're a mitztayer. You're supposed to be in simply. If a person's been starved, if you're suffering, then you don't fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah. So when it rains, so people are makbid to say kiddush. There's no reason to sit in a sukkah when it's raining. That's not the purpose of the sukkah. If it's causing you... Now, if you're a tzaddik, and you love the rain so much, you're not suffering, you could make a case for saying you made a chiyuv, but that's a whole lot of discussion. Well, plug, whatever, fine. So I said, you know what? I'm not a posek, but I think this is mitzvah. There's no reason to sit in the sukkah. I said, we're not even going to set the table. We're going to set the table inside, we'll make kiddush in the sukkah, and we'll come and eat inside. I get a call from one of the local rabbis that week. He says to me, listen, you know, I heard that you paskined that, you know, you don't have to sit in the sukkah here. And I said, well, if I paskin that way, but I told my guests, we're not sitting in the sukkah because I think it's mitzdayer. He said, yeah, but if you do that, nobody's ever going to sit in the sukkah. I said, wait a second, do you agree with me that this is mitzdayer? Like, if a person owns their house and they want to build a sukkah with an air conditioner, you could do that. But I'm not putting an air conditioner in a sukkah that I'm only in here, as far as I know, for a year, right? I also can't afford it. So I don't think I have a chiyuv to sit in the sukkah. Can you debate that? He goes, no, it's true. But people will stop sitting in the sukkah. I said, there's a fundamental problem here. You know what the problem is? You're doing this in Florida. You belong in Israel. Here, it makes sense to keep Sukkot. So now you have that opportunity. You're here. It's beautiful here on Sukkot. The weather is sweet. Right? And you're going to sit in your sukkah, and Rav Judah, who gets so much credit, and all the guys who helped him, who built these four Sukkot, which is unbelievable. We never had that before. So that you can all sit and really have a proper suda, not sitting 70 people through plastic. You can mama sit in a sukkah. What do you think about? The maisa mitzvah. Remember we talked about the difference between the action and the essence of the mitzvah? The maase mitzvah is to sit in a sukkah. If you sit in a sukkah, it's alach sukkah, you make a bracha leishav a sukkah, yishtabach shemo, you fulfill the mitzvah. But did the mitzvah fulfill you? What's the kiyum mitzvah? What's the essence of the mitzvah? It's v'samachta b'chagecha. Am I experiencing the frailty of life? Am I experiencing, am I conscious of what a gift life really is? How temporary life is? How much I should appreciate every moment of life that I'm given? And that is the mitzvah of sukkah. And I think that's what Yaakov was doing here. And I think that's the message that we need to take with us into the sukkah. Chag Sameach.